everyone. Welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Along with me, the one and only Mr. Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hey there.
Another week is here, my friend. Hard to believe how quick these things are peeling past. Can you believe? I mean, we're already into July of 2021. It feels like we were just in the middle of the pandemic of 2020, and we're already halfway or crossing the halfway line into 2021.
Yeah, I had a productive July 4th weekend. I now can only count to eight. So yeah, it was a good weekend. Yeah.
Is that because of your mental acuity being blown away, or the fingers on your hands keeping you from being able to continue to count up higher?
Let's just say the acuity is as it always has been.
So we're lucky you're getting up to eight is what you're saying.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. Well, it's good to be back with everybody. We've got an interesting guest joining us today, because today's topic is going to bridge both the supernatural and true crime in a way only our guest can bring to us. I was really lucky earlier this year. I got a chance to work, and I can't go into too much of the specifics on it, but I can say that I got to work on a really interesting project that'll be televised hopefully later on this year. And I got to work with this gentleman, and it was the first time I think we've ever had a chance to work together, especially on camera. So it was a great opportunity for us. And I believe, if I remember correctly, Sam was called in to be kind of a quick little talking head, and ended up connecting so well that he was with us throughout the entire shoot of this special, and it's going to be pretty interesting. It definitely was one of the weirdest experiences I've ever had investigating a location, Tim. Ladies and gentlemen, joining us, Sam Beltrusis. He's the author of Wicked Salem, Exploring Lingering Lore and Legends, and he's penned a dozen historical-based ghost books, including Ghostwriters and the book we're here to talk to him about today, Mass Murders. He's been featured on several national TV shows, including the Travel Channel's A Haunting, Most Terrifying Places, Haunted Towns, and Haunted USA on Salem, and served as Boston's paranormal expert on the Biography Channel's Haunted Encounters. In 2019, he was featured on the 100th episode of A Haunting that aired on Travel Channel. Beltrusis is a sought-after lecturer who speaks at dozens of paranormal-related events scattered throughout New England, including an author discussion at the Massachusetts State House and paranormal conventions that he produced, called the Plymouth Paracon in 2018 and the Berkshire's Mass Paracon in 2019. We do have a link for him. You can find him at sambeltrusis.com. for more information. And we're also going to be working together. We've got an interesting cruise coming up. It's good to have you join us again, Sam. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Dave. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thank you very much for being a part of it today. You know, it's interesting to get to talk to you under the umbrella of the true crime angle for the show, as I know that you've visited with us in the past regarding the straight up paranormal. This will be an interesting opportunity for us to kind of do something a little different and dive deeper into cases of supernatural and true crime coming together. But I do want to mention that November 11th through the 14th, 2022, there's a Wicked Salem cruise, and Sam has invited me to be a part of this. November 15th, I think, is the tour of Salem, Massachusetts as well. So we do have tickets and information up at darknessevents.com. That's darknessevents.com. Tell people what they can expect with this cruise.
So, Dave, it's going to be a five-day adventure. We're going to start off in Quincy, Massachusetts, on board the USS Salem, which I know very well. And that's going to be on the Thursday. And then it's going to be a cruise leaving from Boston, Massachusetts, heading to Bermuda. We're going to really focus on the Salem witch trials, which is my specialty. Not only am I related to the Putnam family, which who are the major accusers during the Salem witch trials, but I also am a historian who has focused on the witch trials for many years. So we're going to talk about witch hunts, like not only in Salem, but also throughout the world, and also in Bermuda as well. There were several women who were executed for witchcraft in Bermuda. On the way back, we're going to actually go to Salem, Massachusetts, and go to many of the locations that we talk about during the cruise, and do a one-day adventure in my home turf of Salem, Massachusetts.
Very cool. And tickets are up and available. People can go book now. This is, again, for November of 2022, but the tickets and information is up on the site already. Well, let's
go ahead. Basically, just you put down a deposit. So if you wanted to go, you reserve your room now, and they have a special. It's 2-for-1. So if you are going with two people, you can actually reserve for $150 now and pay for the full cruise in July of 2022.
Awesome. Very, very cool. I'm going to be a part of it. Who else is going to be there with us, Sam?
So right now we have James Anito, who is a demonologist, and my good friend and fellow clairvoyant. And she's actually a descendant of the Elizabeth Howe, who's one of the victims of the witch trials. Her name is Dana Mason. She and I have worked together on TV, and she's amazing. So she also is tied to Lizzie Borden through blood as well. So we have a lot to talk about.
Very cool. There's going to be a lot to discuss, a lot to have fun with. So make sure you go get your tickets now, guys, or at least put your deposit down for this. It's going to be a lot of fun. Let's get into the book. And this is cool. Mass Murderers, Bloodstained Crime Scenes Haunting the Bay State. And obviously, having a connection to Lizzie Borden, which we've covered a lot on the show. We'll get to that in a little bit. But there are a lot of bizarre crimes. And I didn't realize this until, within the last year here that right even near the Lizzie Borden home, there's a lot of death and murder. And it's like there is a darkness that has fallen over that entire area, Sam.
Yeah, Dave, I really strongly feel like that it's connected to the land. And there's a lot, specifically in Freetown State Forest, that there was the satanic panic. There were a lot of kind of senseless murders that happened. It may have been satanic ritual related murders that happened in the Freetown State Forest. There's historic crimes going back for many hundreds of years and actually tied to my family lineage. It starts back in the 1600s with Rebecca Cornell, who was allegedly murdered by her son, Thomas Cornell. And what's interesting, if you look at the string, like the family lineage, all of us are connected to one person. Her name is Innocent Cornell. In her last, she was actually a Borden as well. And so it's weird if you look at the murders, they're all oddly tied to my family lineage in that area.
Wow, that's got to be a little strange for you. Having
it is.
these connections that way. But Innocence, first of all, that seems like an ironic name for the amount of tragedy that surrounds the family.
Yeah, and that's the kind of the irony, and also to the big mystery, quite the question mark on the family lineage, is because we thought she was a lake. So Innocent, she was called Innocent Lake Cornell for many years, and it wasn't until about 10 years ago that the Ancestry.com put two and two together that actually this woman was a Cornell. And she was Sarah Earle, who is my connector to the family, was pregnant while her husband, Thomas Cornell, was in trial for the murder of his mother, and he was executed. And so Innocent was basically a bold statement to say, my husband was innocent. So her name was a statement in itself.
That's pretty bizarre. Well, let's get into some of the violence. Obviously, Massachusetts has been a state surrounded in controversy and, with the witchcraft trials and Lizzie Borden murders. And, a lot of people know about Lizzie and certainly have heard that story, but not, they don't really realize all of the other the tragedies. And when you're uncovering this and then realize you have ties to so many of the players in these stories, Sam, what's that like for you? I mean, are you ever concerned, geez, is this like a genetic thing, a curse on the family?
Well, I genuinely think that there's something going on. And, when I worked on Mass Murders, the book, I knew about the connection to the Putnam family, who were the major accusers during the Salem witch trials. But my mother, who's kind of like the family genealogist, she was like, Sam, there's more to this. And I'm like, Mom, I can't handle that right now. I can't handle any more ties that's going to blow my mind. And she's like, she tells me later that we're also related to Lizzie Borden. And I was like, oh my God. And that just was the tip of the iceberg. There's been multiple people that we've uncovered. My mother kind of leading the way with the Ancestry.com research to a lot of murderers and also victims as well. So yeah, it's kind of weird connecting to these people. And to add to it, I'm clairvoyant. So I'm not only am I, you know, doing the research to these crimes, but I'm also connecting to them on a very deep level as a clairvoyant.
Well, and I've got to guess that's kind of an interesting aspect of this as well, right? That somebody who is a clairvoyant and is in an area so rich with history and death and trauma from the indigenous peoples and the settlers, the colonialists, and I mean, it's just been a bloody swath in that area. And then to know that you've got blood ties to these stories, does it get overwhelming as a sensitive to, you know, kind of be steeped in that area constantly?
I think it actually, it's kind of like it's meant to be. And I grew up in Florida of all places. So I was initially in Chicago when I was young. And then I grew up in Florida and moved to Massachusetts for college in the 90s. So I felt called to this area as a young boy. I got chosen to go to college in Boston, and it just kind of has been something that's always kind of been part of my existence. And I overwhelming, no, but I think as far as like, I feel like I'm at the right place to do what I'm supposed to do. So it's more like acceptance, accepting that this is what I'm supposed to do and I got to figure out how to do it.
All right. Well, now going into some of these murders and, you know, the historic crimes of that area, now, was there much that happened through Massachusetts, with these strange murders and crime waves prior to the witchcraft trials and prior to that black stain on our country's history?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of mass murders is really diving into the King Philip. And there's a lot of there was a lot of genocide related to the Native Americans in this area. So yeah, I mean, there was bloodshed in the 1600s when the pilgrims came over on the Mayflower. Soon after, they kind of ravaged the land and also, you know, killed many of the people. Many of the people who actually fed them, including King Philip, who they destroyed. They killed them and they cut them into pieces and put them on a pike in the middle of Plymouth. So yeah, the Native American massacres that happened on our land predates the Salem witch trials.
Right. And again, that just is the beginning. As somebody who understands true crime and looks at these things from a spiritual perspective, you know, we talk a lot about on our paranormal show, the fact that we leave things scarred. We leave them with this impression when there's enough bloodshed. Do you believe that that's true? You know, do we really leave a tear in the fabric of space-time with all the violence and hatred and anger and destruction that takes place in an area? And then does that continue to have a ripple effect through history?
I really do, Dave. I think that specifically in Salem, Massachusetts, the land is stained with blood. And I feel that's the case with the Freetown State Forest, the Bridgewater Triangle, all the areas that we talk about in our history books. There's this dark energy that's still lingering on the land. And as a clairvoyant, I'm feeling that energy and connecting with it and also trying to get answers while I'm connecting with this darkness. So yeah, I do think the land is stained with blood and a lot of it was innocent blood.
And do you think that's what makes it, I don't know, even more negative, is because there was this innocence to what was taken, almost like blood sacrifice? But now that blood, you know, there's vengeance, there's anger, there's resentment towards all of the people that have been killed unceremoniously through history. That's created kind of this dark pocket of energy throughout that area.
Yeah, I really do. I mean, I think that a lot of the murders were, are kind of like replaying on the land. So when you look at mass murders, a lot of the people that I talk about are either victims or perpetrators from years ago. We're talking hundreds of years ago, and they're still sticking around. When I say they're sticking around, I mean as in spirit form. And so I do think that the it has left a scar on the land, and that also that scar actually kind of works as a portal to other entities and other energies that kind of come into the land. And, you know, so we're not only picking up the original ghosts, but also the new spirits or the activity from modern day. So we have, not only do we have ghosts from 300 years ago, but we have current ghosts that from recently that are still kind of like lingering in New England.
As somebody who's sensitive to this, when you're out and about, I mean, are you overwhelmed by the spirits of these murders, of these violent crimes and crimes against humanity? And what if anything, do they tell you?
You know, Dave, I am overwhelmed, but I also think that it's what I'm supposed to do. So I kind of take it. I'm like, this is what I'm supposed to do. So I really try my best to give a voice to those without a voice. So if it's, say, a family member who was murdered, and or maybe she was a murderer, like potentially, you know, Lizzie Borden, or my other relative, Eliza Darling Borden, she was not blood relation, but she was tied to me through her children. And so I feel strongly, specifically towards giving a voice to women in the marginalized community, whether it's people of color, children, the Native Americans, definitely. So I try my best to focus on the ones who didn't have a voice back, you know, 300 years ago.
Well, let's start diving into some of the cases that really kind of captured your attention and focus through your, you know, not even just what you've put in the book, but through your walk through history. What are some of the other more bizarre murder cases and stories that have crossed your desk?
Well, so for mass murders, like I was kind of told I could not focus on modern crime, which was kind of like a downer for me, because I really wanted to focus on, you know, recent cases. So I had to kind of really dig into history books to find cases in Massachusetts that still have lingering energy associated with it. And I found a lot, actually. So I think for me, the one that kind of sticks in my mind and continues to haunt me is the Lady of the Dunes case in Provincetown. And that was actually, you know, a cold case, and I was able to focus on it because it's close to being 50 years old, and trying to give this woman a name. And so I keep going back to Provincetown, trying to dig deeper and connect with her spirit to hopefully give this woman a name and some closure in the afterlife.
All right. Well, talk to us a little bit about this case and give us the legacy of it all.
Yeah. So the Lady of the Dunes, she doesn't have a name. So she was found on Race Point Beach, which is right in Provincetown, Massachusetts, which is the tip of Cape Cod. She was found on the beach on a towel. Her head was almost decapitated. Her hands were cut off, severely mauled by several people. And for years they have tried to, you know, find like who was the murderer. And one of the suspects was actually a gentleman named Tony Costa, who we learned that he was a serial killer of several women in Provincetown back in 69. And he was in jail, so he probably could not have committed that murderer. But I suspect that there was someone that he worked with, and he talks about, that may have committed the murder on the Lady of the Dunes. So trying to get to who committed the crime and the connection has been kind of like my passion for the past 10 years.
All right. Well, looking at the case, talk us through what happened. I mean, obviously they find this body, but, you know, is this a well-tread area? Is, you know, had other murders and strange things happened in that area? What all do we know about it?
Well, so we know the woman was found around this time in the early 70s, and she was on the beach, on the towel. We know that. For many years, we thought that maybe that there was ties to the Boston mob scene, like Whitey Bulger. In fact, in my book, I kind of go into the possibility that Whitey Bulger was responsible. We know that Whitey did go to Provincetown often to kind of escape Boston. And if you looked at the sort of like the way the body was left on the beach, like it looked like a mob kill. So I really looked into the possibility that maybe Whitey Bulger was in fact responsible for the murders. However, if you talk to several of his accomplices, they say that it wasn't Whitey. So I think that Whitey Bulger, even though there's a lot of evidence on the beach, including a size 10 foot imprint in the sand, that would implicate Whitey Bulger. However, I don't think that.
Well, is that his MO? I mean, is that just random murders of people like that? That'd be something Whitey Bulger would be, you know, I didn't know that aspect of his story.
Well, I mean, so kind of give you some backstory, Whitey. So he was a notorious mobster. If you've seen The Departed, the hitman was basically based on Whitey Bulger. He definitely would murder people in kind of in a typical mob scene if it was an issue of power. But he also, if there were women that were part of his crew, and if they knew too much, he would murder them. So Deborah Davis, who was murdered by Whitey Bulger, she knew too much, and so the women that were involved generally were either in relationships with him or with someone in his group. So yeah, that would be his MO definitely, especially if he had an affair with her.
Okay. Now you said what the shoe size was like a 10, 10 and a half, which would put it right in Whitey Bulger. Unfortunately, half the people in my house, all right, have that same footprint. So, you know, that's a tough nut to crack, but I get where you're going with this. She ends up being murdered. She's on this. Is there any, you know, during all of this, is there any kind of breakthroughs or aspects of what they, you know, the official story is and, you know, tying to who they think this woman might be? Because I've got to guess at some point, somebody's got to recognize her. Somebody's got to know what happened. And did people ever come forward, but it was kind of shunned or pushed aside?
Yeah, I mean, like, so there were a lot of theories. And what's odd about it is that several people came forward, like they're missing loved ones. Maybe it's them. And they were able to actually to rule out those people. One theory is perhaps she was originally from Ireland. Her profile actually would fit an Irish woman. But the thing about her specifically is she had really good, they called it New York teeth. So she was someone who was well taken care of as far as like her teeth were in really good condition, even though her head was nearly decapitated and she was obviously tortured. But yeah, I mean, I do think that there's something an idea maybe she was, you know, a prostitute or a lady of ill repute. But I actually do, I worked on a documentary before you and I worked together on this case, and we're going to kind of go into possible other scenarios in this documentary. It's called Historically Haunted Cape Cod, where I actually channeled the what was going on there. And there were actually ties to, in this documentary, I talk about potential ties to the cult, the Fall River cult murders that happened as well. So I don't know if there's any ties to that, but it came through in the spirit realm that maybe there was somehow a tie to the cult murders that happened in Fall River in the late 70s, early 80s.
All right. Well, we'll be digging into that as well, I'm sure, in a few moments, because, again, that was some of the startling revelations I found out about this year that really just blew my mind. Again, you know, we're very familiar with the satanic panic and all the false claims and things that went through. But there are real stories. There are real negativities that took place. And, you know, they need to be spoken about. They need to be shared. But as you're looking at this Lady of the Dunes now, what is the paranormal aspect of this? Is she seen there often? And if so, in what shape and in what regards?
Yeah. So I have worked with a lot of locals and when it comes to like telling their stories, and I'll tell you specifically with that case and Tony Costa, they don't want to talk about it. So people that have like grown up in Provincetown, they know things, but they don't want to talk about it. And it's a very tight-knit Portuguese community. And I have talked to people off their record on what they think may have been, you know, who did it, that kind of thing. And I will say that there's a lot that is being kind of hushed up for various reasons. and maybe perhaps the murderer is still out there, which is, and that's the thing, like that's what the local rumor is, but I also have to kind of protect my sources and myself, because we, you know, it's coming up on 50 years. So the person would be like in his 80s. I'm sure he would not be a threat. But if you really look at even Tony Costa, he didn't act alone. And he actually said this. He wrote a book called The Secret Garden. And in the book, he said he actually worked with a gentleman named Carl, and that they were together when they committed the murders. So who was this Carl, and why haven't we talked to him?
Really? When talking to law enforcement or reading through the documents and such, why do you feel that they would leave some stones unturned? Again, was it because there was some corruption maybe at the time and they were told to look past some people?
Yeah, I mean, especially if it's a small town, and like Provincetown and Fall River, it's a very tight-knit, protect-your-neighbor kind of community. So if, say, you're a son of a police officer, or if your family ties are connected to the government, maybe that there's a cover up. And if you like The Departed, like Whitey Bulger, he had ties as well, and he got away with a lot of murder because of those family ties. So I do think that there's something to that. We're really good in New England, and specifically in Massachusetts, of kind of protecting our own. And not, kind of keeping quiet when it comes to certain cases, especially if it's, if it's a case that may implicate one of their brothers or one of their people that are part of their families.
Like, I get the let's take care of one another. Let's get, take care of our own, but not to the degree of hiding murder. I mean, to me, that just seems insane.
It really is, but I think that there's rumor and then there's fact, and I think that when it comes to like there may be another accomplice with the Tony Costa murders, I think that's local rumor, and he also said that himself. And why wasn't this other person even questioned? However, a lot of the people, like especially in Provincetown with Tony Costa, he had a wife and children. So the children grew up with the people that I talked to, and they know the family. And it's like, they don't want to talk about this case. This case has scarred that family for years. And they call him Tony Chop Chop Costa. And if you refer to him as Tony Chop Chop, they flip out. And when I say they, I'm talking about people that were friends growing up with his children. So I do think it's also not only is it protecting murderers, but it's also protecting the families also. And that's also too why my publisher was like, Sam, like try to stay away from crimes that are less than 50 years ago because of that, because I don't want to get sued. And also too, I don't want to kind of poke the bear when it comes to crimes that that need to be solved and that the spirits need to have postmortem peace. But we also have family members that are still around who are still scarred by it.
Well, let's talk about, this kind of, and I know this is more recent, not quite 50 years, but let's talk about that kind of brutal, sacrificial type murders that took place in the 70s, wasn't it? Out in the woods over there?
So the Carl Drew murders, and Carl Drew is still alive. And there was an accomplice that he basically was like a pimp, and he would allegedly have like black masses out in the middle of the near the Hockomock Swamp in the Freetown State Forest, and he would do they said human sacrifices. So there were several women that were part of this group, and some of them weren't even part of the group, but that were sacrificed and brutally, brutally murdered out in Fall River.
All right. So walk us through the time frame on this. What do you know about this whole story?
All right, so I have to kind of refresh my memory. But yeah, so basically, like, there's this Carl Drury, I'm assuming, I think it's in the late 70s, but this was in Freetown State Forest. He had several women that were kind of part of his group. So think of like Charles Manson. They supposedly did satanic rituals. So they would do like moon rituals, blood rituals, that kind of thing. They would do it in Freetown State Forest. It would start off with, say, like animal sacrifices, and then it supposedly escalated to actual people. And there was one woman, and I totally forget her name, but she people think that this woman was the ringleader of the group, and Carl Drew was kind of like the scapegoat for the group. And the documentary, which I haven't seen, but I heard it's fantastic, goes really kind of into the impact it had on the community.
Do you believe that there was something to this satanic side of it and ritualistic side? Or do you think that these were just violent crimes perpetrated by a pimp, you know, by a bad guy? Where do you draw that line?
I personally think that they did play into the satanic panic. When I say they, I'm talking about the press. I'm talking about the prosecutors. And I think that there was that genuine fear that also fed people like Ed Marine Warren back in that era too. So I think the satanic panic was real, and people were terrified of demonic possession and demons and satanic worship and that sort of thing. So I do think that that was real. And probably if we had this case in modern times, the devil would play less of a role. But I do think that they did have rituals out in Freetown State Forest. Robin Murphy is her name. Robin was, you know, she was young, and they have interviewed her, and she's always kind of changed her story when it comes to the actual murders, like her role in it. And she, you know, she was given immunity, so she was able to kind of like come up with these like really elaborate stories involving satanic worshiping and sacrifices and that sort of thing. And a lot of it, they think, is her imagination, that she was the one that was actually responsible. And Carl, even though he was part of it, he was not the actual ringleader, and Robin Murphy was.
Okay. And the way these murders took place, though, it definitely looks into that ritualistic aspect. Do you think that that was a tact in order to make it look like it fit this bill, but it was really over other things, and they were just trying to deflect and put people on the wrong path, like the Manson murders? You know, they killed it and then tried to make it look like it was a race war, that it was African Americans that had possibly perpetrated this crime.
I think a little bit of both. I think that there definitely was ritualistic aspects to what they were doing. And the evidence does support that. However, you know, I think they're using that as sort of like a, you know, to make the story more interesting. I think that it was like front page news in Massachusetts for years, and people kind of going into the case. So it was kind of like the trial of the century. And when you add those satanic elements to it, it really fed into the fear and to the mindset of people at that time. So I do think that the ritualistic aspect of what they were doing was definitely a byproduct of the satanic panic era. But I don't think it was as intense as, say, it was portrayed. And it wasn't as intense as Robin Murphy portrayed it in her testimony. So I do think that they were definitely, you know, responsible for these heinous murders involving these young women. But I also think that, like you said, he was a pimp, and he was basically, you know, drug induced psychosis, basically. So I do think that there was other stuff going on as well.
Crazy. And to have that happen, I mean, my God, how did that affect the community to have murders like that taking place, and especially have it tied to something so dark and sinister?
I definitely think that it fed the satanic panic. And I think that people were, you know, the Exorcist was a huge thing, and like it was a huge hit. So everybody was looking for the devil and lurking in the corners. And so it fed into that fear. So I think, and it, you know, from a paranormal perspective, that fear makes it stronger. So there were definitely paranormal, there's still lingering energy in that area. And that's actually in my book, Mass Murders, as well, like walking through the Freetown State Forest and having multiple experiences, like walking through it. So I do think it's sacred land, but is it stained with the blood of those innocent women? It is, but there's stuff that goes way back, even further back to the Native Americans that's staining that land as well. So I think that it's just a vortex of supernatural energy, and it's, you know, it's about to explode.
Yikes. Well, I'm glad I don't live in Massachusetts. That's for sure. Now, looking at some of the other crimes that have happened throughout Massachusetts history and some of the ones that you cover in the book, are there any that as you're writing it, you're connecting spiritually, you know, intuitively with, that just kind of override you and freak you out?
Yeah, I think the murders that are related to my family. I think that anything, now that I know kind of like the basic structure of my family, it all makes sense to me now. I didn't know that I was related to the Putnam family, who were the major accusers in the witch trials. And I definitely didn't know I was related to Lizzie Borden, but I've been studying this for years. So the fact that I actually, you know, I'm a tour guide in Salem, Massachusetts, talking about the Putnam family on my tours before I even knew I was related to them, to me, it kind of makes my life make sense. But I definitely feel that anything that's related to, say, the Putnams, and also to the victims, to my cousin Ann Putnam Jr. accused 62 people of witchcraft. And I'll tell you, when I give my tours in Salem and when I talk about the victims, I feel like I feel that guilt. I feel that, you know, like my cousin, who was a child when she was an afflicted girl. So she, you know, she did actually make an apology years later, saying that she was kind of under the influence of Satan. And she was, you know, she basically apologized, but still, like, that apology doesn't take away the innocent men and women who were hanged for witchcraft, and they were good people.
Yeah, that's a pretty tough pill to swallow. You know, it's interesting, especially with the popularity of The Conjuring, and we just, you know, Jeff Belanger and I just did an episode on The Devil Made Me Do It last week. And here we've got a case where, you know, she makes her apologies and claims to be under the influence of the devil. Do you believe that she really believed that, or was she just trying to deflect to, you know, gain sympathy and, oh, well, it wasn't her fault, the devil was trying to influence her, that kind of thing? Where do you lie? And I know it's tough because it's family, but what do you think?
I genuinely think that she lost everything. So there was a huge backlash toward the people that were the perpetrators. So I think she was trying to basically get her life back. She lost her life. She was in her 30s. She lost her mother and father, you know, Ann Putnam, who was her mother, and then also her father, Thomas Putnam. And she was trying to survive and raise her siblings. So I do think that her apology was legit. I think that she genuinely was sorry, but I think that the if you look at how the community responded, they didn't welcome her back to the church. So she continued to be ostracized from the church. And also too, because she was a woman, she wasn't able to read the apology in front of the congregation. Actually, Reverend Green read it because he was the reverend. And so I do think that there was, you know, definitely some remorse on her part, but in the afterlife, there's still unfinished business. I mean, it has left a psychic scar on the land, and a lot of the victims are still lingering, and they're lingering, and they want post-mortem justice. And guess what? You know, like they go after me, because apparently now that I'm related to, you know, to Ann Putnam Jr., her ancestors are paying for the family sins, and I feel passionate that I have that responsibility to somehow bring those victims peace in the afterlife.
You look at the traumatic way this happened and these kind of waves that come and create chaos in a family bloodline. Do you believe that curses exist and can affect us? Or do you believe that we create our own curses because of the actions or sometimes non-actions that we take in these heinous situations?
You know, Dave, I really when coming in, I was kind of, you know, I didn't think the idea of curses being real. I remember when I first started working in Salem, people talked about the Giles Corey curse. And Giles Corey was the an older man who was accused of witchcraft. And actually, my cousin, Ann Putnam Jr., accused Giles Corey. He was pressed to death over a 2, maybe 3 day period. And he, allegedly, before he passed, he said, "I curse you," referring to the Sheriff George Corwin, "and I curse Salem." And I, you know, I thought that that was sort of like local legend, made up stuff. But I'll tell you, having spent many years in Salem and researching it, I do think that that curse was legit. So I do think, especially when it's related to someone that was wrongly accused and executed, I do think that if they did in fact place a curse, and you don't have, they were innocent men and women, so they weren't witches. They could be normal people who were wrongly executed, can release a curse. So I do think that curses are real. I think that if you look at The Devil Made Me Do It, like the witch's curse, that's part of the film, which was not part of the actual story. I don't think that that type of cursing, witches don't curse people, which is actually, if a witch curses somebody, it comes back to them and is not good. So I think that curses are real, but I think it's not coming from witches. It's coming from other people.
Okay. All right. From that anger, resentment, that intention of hatred that they put on one another.
Right. And Giles Corey is supposedly cursed, and he was pressed to that. I would curse Salem too. And Sarah Good, who was a town beggar woman, she also cursed the family, and she was a town, she would go from door to door begging for food. And actually, my cousin didn't accuse Sarah Good, but she was accused, and she lost her baby in the dungeon. And her child, Dorothy, was also accused, and she wasn't executed, but she was in prison in a dungeon, you know, pregnant. And so she supposedly cursed the reverend who accused her. So yeah, I do think that these people, that curse, especially in the 1600s, was the norm. You know, it was like, "I curse you, I curse you." And justifiably so. I mean, these people's lives were destroyed.
Oh, that's heartbreaking. Just heartbreaking. Now, you launch in this, you had no idea that you were related to the Putnams or to the Bordens, but you know, as you keep unveiling parts of your story and as you keep digging deeper, you find these connections. I'm just curious, have you noticed, or have you, I don't know, I want to phrase this right, because I think I would kind of want to turn a blind eye to it. I mean, have you ever looked back at other aspects of your family since then? Are there any other crimes associated with your family members, either they're the victims or they're the perpetrators? Has that continued on as a cruel cyclical way?
Yeah, so it's weird, like since kind of coming out that I'm related to the Putnams and also to Lizzie Borden, there are several people that have come into my life since then who also have that same lineage. And it's interesting, the people that I've connected to, one of them is, her name's Laura Brand, and she is a serial killer expert. And she is working on the Toolbox Killer case in California. And it's weird, I think that she said this about kind of our family line. We're like hunters. So we have to hunt for information. So a lot of our family, if you look down the family lineage, a lot of us are investigators. A lot of us are researchers. And some of us kind of go the opposite direction and hunt people. And that's definitely the case with several of our family members. And I don't want to give too much away, but I will tell you this. We have a long list of victims and perpetrators that blew me away. And this came out from recent research. And I will say this, there was one case, I'll give you one name, Eileen Warnos. She is a serial killer.
Sure. Florida. Monster, right?
Yeah. Monster. Yeah. And I was blown away when I found out that she was connected to us as well. And so that's a modern case, but we have cases going back to the 1600s. And what's even more strange is they're all connected to one person, Innocent Borden. And that's the weird thing. Like if you look at the lineage and to all these murderers and victims, they're all connected to innocent Cornell Borden. And why is that? And is that the source of the family curse?
So can people just be born evil, right? Is there a genetic connection that then spreads like a virus through family lines?
If you look at the people that are involved, what's really interesting about these people is a lot of them, especially in the afterlife, especially like Lizzie Borden, for example, or even Eileen Wuornos, they're kind of like vulnerable people. And when I say vulnerable, like they weren't born evil. And I don't think Lizzie Borden was born evil. I don't think Eileen Wuornos was born evil. I think that she may have had sensitivities to say the spirit realm, or may have been clairvoyant. And even looking back at Ann Putnam Jr., she would have visions. She would have like dreams and that sort of thing that I would identify as being clairvoyant. So maybe they're not born evil, but maybe they're born with something else, like a sensitivity that other people just don't have. And I think that if you look at down the line, that's the part that I'm kind of fascinated in, is there any paranormal, like did they have prophetic dreams, or did they have visions like I do? And is that the family curse? Is the curse somehow related to my clairvoyance? And I think if you really look at these people and the individuals, they definitely were traumatized by something, like something that sometimes it was good, you know, and they did good things, and sometimes it was something sinister. So they were they had the proclivity to, I guess, attract a sinister entity, I guess, if you would say.
Wow. That's really kind of a chilling aspect of all of this. And then to see it, you know, continue to branch out. Let's dig into the Borden family and the kind of death that surrounded them. A lot of people are very familiar with Lizzie Borden, but there are other elements and deaths that were associated with family members, even next door. Can we go into that a little bit?
Yeah, so there's something that, and you mentioned Jeff Belanger, he actually was one of the first people to talk about this on television. But yeah, there was a case involving Eliza Darling Borden that happened, I think 30 years before the actual, it was 1892 was the Borden murders, but this happened several decades before. And so Eliza Darling Borden she was a mother of several children, and I'm connected to those children. One of them was a little boy named Holder. And then there was her younger daughter, also called Eliza. And they believe she had postpartum depression. And so she, according to, you know, the newspaper accounts, she took her children and she drowned them in a well, which was right next door to the Lizzie Borden bed and breakfast in Fall River. And then she takes her husband's straight razor and cuts her neck and commits suicide. Now, this woman, I didn't know much about for years, but I do know as a clairvoyant that she does kind of, she doesn't come into the house for some reason, because I think that her children are in the house. And I think Eliza definitely has unfinished business, but I don't think that she was in her right mind when she committed that crime. And she has a lot of guilt associated with the deaths of her children. And so I think that, her case is also something that needs to be, I guess, re-explored, because it's a little known case and they kind of just wrote it off as postpartum depression. But was there something more sinister at play? Was there, you know, was she under attack spiritually? And I think that's viable. I think that she could have been.
Because, again, if you're in this position, people have to understand, you know, postpartum depression, a very real affliction. And if you're already kind of predisposed to this crack, this breakdown mentally, could something dark influence you?
Right. And that's kind of what I get from from her. And I think that she has a lot of guilt, but I think she also, and this goes for Cousin Lizzie as well, she doesn't think that she committed the murders. Like, she wasn't there mentally when the murders took place. And I think that you know, having been taken over myself, I had an attachment myself that nearly killed me, and I would go in and out of consciousness. And having had that experience myself, I suspect that maybe my relatives had the same, like they may have had an attachment.
Or is that what we want to tell ourselves so that we don't face the truth of just how brutal we can be to one another?
Yeah, but you have to look at their intention. And I think that with Eliza specifically, she loved her children. And I think that she, you know, yeah, she probably had severe postpartum depression. It's a very real mental condition. But I also think that she was not in her right mind. You know, was she even cognizant when she committed, when she killed two of her children and the third got away, or then committed suicide, or was she not there? And I suspect that she wasn't there because she has a lot of guilt in the afterlife. Like, I would never murder my children kind of thing. And, you know, do I think someone else did it? I don't. I think she did do it, but her physical body committed the crime, but her mental cognizant side wasn't there when it was happening.
Is there a possibility that she came upon her children dead and did, you know, took her own life because as a mom, she couldn't live with that?
That's very possible. And like that, and that would implicate the husband, and he was abortion. He was connected to my family. So I wouldn't be surprised based on my family research. And so yeah, Lodwick was her husband. And, you know, from all accounts, he was a kind of a laid back kind of guy, but looking at all the other murderers in my family, all of them were kind of laid back guys and girls too. So I don't know. I mean, I mean that would actually make more sense to me that the husband did actually commit the murders, because she just didn't have, she wasn't a killer. This woman, Eliza, she was not. And, you know, I don't think I want to believe that she would commit the crimes. And I don't think she wants to think that in the afterlife. And, you know, maybe she needs to face the facts that she did. But I will say this, as a clairvoyant who connects with her spirit strongly, she wants the children to cross to the light. She wants to give the children, because the children have kind of stayed back for whatever reason, and she wants them to go to the light.
Well, I understand that as a parent. You certainly don't want to believe that your kids are left wandering the planet aimlessly as spirits. You want them to feel that they've got a place to go and a safe zone. As a parent, I don't know that I could move on comfortably either. So you've got that horrific murder that predates the murder suicide that predates the Borden family. Do you believe that also plays a part into the darkness of the land and then what happens with the Bordens themselves?
I really do, Dave. I think that I always say my famous line, the land is stained with blood, but yeah, like that part of Fall River, there's a lot of blood and there's a lot of pain. And I do think that the land has energy to it. I mean, I've investigated the Borden house many, many times. And not only do I encounter the Borden family, Abby and Andrew, but I also encounter other spirits that were murdered as well. I mean, there was a lot of murder. Like, that's not the best part of Fall River. There's been other things that have happened around there. And I've also had...
Wait a minute. You know, the murder's not the best part? That's hard to believe, Sam.
Exactly. Like, there's a lot has happened there. And so I do think that, I think that there was the Native American backstory to it as well. I think the land is cursed from the Native Americans. Look at King Philip. He was the gentleman that I was talking about earlier, who was at first, you know, friends with the settlers, but then decided that the pilgrims were taking over his land and was quartered and his head was put on a pike. And I think that when it comes to connecting with the spirits, I've also connected with Native Americans at the Lizzie Borden Bed and Breakfast. So I definitely have connected with, you know, with the Borden family and also with the natives that were massacred there too.
Well, before we dive into the Borden story, to wrap up with, what other cases do you cover in the book?
So I definitely go into the Whitey Bulger. He was in Provincetown, but a lot of the murders happened in Boston. And I worked at a hotel, and I'm actually holding an event at this hotel. It's called the Adams Inn in Quincy, Massachusetts. And I would have this late night encounters with this woman wearing kind of like a 70s nightgown. And I'm like, who was this woman? And it turns out that Whitey Bulger actually dumped his victims right outside of the hotel that I worked at. So it was like this dead man's dumping ground. And it wasn't just men that were murdered. It was also several women that were murdered too. And he lived nearby in Quincy, and he would actually apparently use that as a grave. So I definitely go into the Whitey Bulger case. I spent a whole section on debunking locations with murderous backstories that actually aren't true. Like, for example, the S.K. Pierce Victorian Mansion in Gardner. There's this whole backstory that was circulating that there was a prostitute that was murdered in the house. And actually, I think it ended up on Ghost Adventures. And actually, there's no proof whatsoever that there was even a prostitution at that house. And kind of going to other legends that have kind of like murderous backstories that may have been made up to kind of to sort of like give a voice to the ghost or put a face to the ghost. For example, the biggest legend in Boston is the Lady in Black in George's Island. And I grew up with that story. I would go out to George's Island, actually gave tours out in Boston Harbor. And unfortunately, that story is completely made up, even though there is a spirit of like that have been people have reported for years of like a black shadow figure that shows up. But they kind of came up with this elaborate backstory of a woman named Melanie Lanier, who was a Confederate soldier's wife who came to rescue her husband. So I also spent a whole section on debunking legends that aren't true.
Okay. And I like the fact that you look into some of these aspects of what people have long believed. Do they get angry when you shine the light of truth on them?
Absolutely. Because a lot of people, especially in Boston, they love the Lady in Black story. There's Edward Rowe Snow, who I really looked up to. He was our local historian. He was single-handedly kind of revitalized the Boston Harbor tourism industry and by telling the story of the Lady in Black. So people grew up hearing about Melanie. She you know, comes to see her husband was kept in the prison at the Fort Warren, and she tries to save him and ends up shooting him. And they according to the story, they hang her in the middle of the courtyard. There were no executions of women on George's Island. Now there were executions there, but they're not of a woman. And I think that people really get upset when they find out that there's no historical truth that supports that story. And I think that, you know, that definitely people, they want to believe that Melanie was real and she was just like this legend that they grew up with, and they don't want to hear otherwise.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. When you've it's a lot like the Ocean Born Mary case, right? For so long, it's been played out one way. And trust me, I know, having gone in and looked at it with the Holzer files and kicked over a bunch of stones, there's a lot of people in that area that are not happy that we proved the fact that, she had no attachment to the house that's, well known for it. And kind of the history has been certainly built upon and built on a really bad foundation of fabrication and lies. So getting to the truth sometimes can irritate people more than it can excite or enlighten them. Exactly. But again, that's the idea. We have to get to the truth. Well, now we're coming into the final stretch. Let's dive a little bit. Of course, you know, we don't want to get too into it because we've covered Lizzie so much, but then the Lizzie Borden murders. I just want to know straight up, do you believe personally that Lizzie or her sister had a hand in these murders?
Okay, before I answer that, because I always feel trapped into this question. I will tell you, Dave. When I was investigating the house, I actually asked the question. You know, did and I don't even want to say this out loud, but did Lizzie kill her father and her stepmother? And I hear a blood curdling scream on the EVP, and I strongly believe it's Lizzie. And she's like, no more. Don't talk about it. Stop asking this question. So I will say this. I think that Lizzie, with all her heart, having communicated with my cousin, specifically at Maplecroft, I always connect with her there and not at the murder house. I made a pact with her that I would never call her back to the Lizzie Borden murder house because she hates going there. I think that I made a pact with her that I would, you know, I would tell her story correctly. She also strongly believes she would talk about this case called Bertha Manchester. And there was a case that happened right around the time that she was actually on trial. So she was in jail when this case happened, but another woman in Fall River was murdered by a hatchet as well. So she wants to find the murderer. She wants to get like post-mortem resolution. But do I think that she committed it? I do. I think that her body, she physically committed it. But I think that, you know, I've had a dream over and over again before I even knew that I was related to Lizzie, or Lizbeth is what she likes to be called. And the dream was like a replay of the murders. And not only was she in the scene, her father was sitting on the couch. She was standing like behind in the kitchen area, or not to the dining room area, kind of looking over. And there was a man with her, and the man was kind of like a puppet master. And I really suspect that it was her uncle, John Morse. So I think that I've always suspected the uncle, John Morse, as being at least an instigator. And she may have committed the actual murders, but I feel like the uncle was the one that was like the puppeteer, because she didn't have it. She didn't have it in her to kill her dad, her stepmother, maybe, but not her dad. So I also suspect that, you know, and I have thought this, but anyway, in the dream, the line below said Diablo did it. And I really think that Diablo did it. I think that she may have been under, either she was in a disassociated state where she kind of detached from where she was and committed the murders and doesn't remember that part, or that she, you know, like that she was possessed, or she was taken over by a dark entity, something more sinister. And that's something that I having had an attachment, I really think that's a possibility.
Right. And obviously, you know, that's been looked at from different people through time, that there may have been a darker influence. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out as more research is done in the future. If that's the case, Sam, and you know you're related to the Borden family, you know that there may be ties to the devil literally making people do it. Does it ever play on you? Does it ever concern you of what other bloodstains may appear in your family lineage, either in the past or in the future?
Yeah, I mean, so Dave, like, yeah, I mean, you, when you and I worked together, you were like, oh, I don't think Sam should stay with us, because you're like worried that I'm going to be like, kind of like walk out, you know, like in a daze. I have been taken over, Dave. And like, I've had an attachment that wanted me dead. And, you know, and it was also, I had dark thoughts while I was under the possession of this entity. So I do think that I'm prone to it. So now but I think for me, like, knowledge is power. I think that now that I know that I have all these blood stains in my lineage, that I know what to look for. And I think the biggest issue for me, because I've been sober for now 12 years, and I think that when I was drinking, I think that like that would have, I would be in a very different place if I continued drinking alcohol. Let's just put it that way. And I think if you look at a lot of the, and that could be the family curse as well. It could be alcoholism. And, you know, that's something that I suspect with not only with Lizzie, but, you know, with the family. I think that that we definitely have alcoholism in our family, and I think that could be a player as well. Like maybe they were in a alcoholic psychosis. So for me, you know, I know that now that I know that I'm related to all these murderers and also all these victims too, I feel that it's my job is not to be one of them. It's to tell their story and to tell their story correctly and to give them postmortem peace. So I know my role, and my role is to kind of chronicle their stories and to help them in the afterlife. And I have like my family, like when my mother that kind of sat me down and told me like the connection to Lizzie Borden, I kind of talked to my family members, because I'm the oldest of five kids, and I had this big story to tell. I'm like, guys, we're connected to Lizzie Borden. I thought that they would be shocked that we're related to Lizzie Borden. My whole family kind of nodded their head. Yep, that makes sense. Yep. they weren't surprised. So I think that if you look at our makeup, I think that we are definitely, a lot of it's positive. So a lot of like what we're born with is like a natural hunting ability. If you take it to be like a forensic psychologist or an investigator, or like myself, I was a journalist for 20 years, and I was a damn good journalist. And I think that some of us take whatever we're given genetically and did great things with it, and others did not. Others kind of took it and did horrible things.
Right. I understand that completely. I talked about that with Jeff last week on the show. That's why I don't drink often in situations where I know there could be an underlying issue. If I'm out, you know, just hanging with buddies, having a few drinks is fine. You know, if I go to a place where I know somebody might be looking to mix it up, or I know that there are some people that make bad decisions when drinking, I try to avoid getting drunk with them, because I know that there's nice, loving Dave, and then there's really dark, mean Dave. And I try to avoid that guy when I'm drinking. So he's kind of a bummer.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. For me, like when I the best thing I ever did was stop drinking. And I think that I was able to kind of like focus on, and I'll tell you, like my abilities as a clairvoyant really exploded after that. My third eye completely opened when I got sober, and I would have visitations from the spirit realm while I was drinking, but I thought I was hallucinating. I didn't know what was real and what wasn't real. And now that I've been sober, I've been able to actually really work on my abilities as a clairvoyant. And I was really happy to see that your co-lead on the Holzer Files, Cindy is also sober. So I think that there's some validity to the fact that like being sober is better, especially when you're a clairvoyant. The alcohol kind of muddles the connection with the spirit realm. And I think that, I don't think everybody should get sober, but I think when you go on an investigation, you definitely should not have drugs or alcohol in your system, because I think it does cloud, the muddle the investigation, and also causes, you know, potentially leads to like people getting taken over. You know, you have to be in your right mind.
100% agree. 100% agree. And especially with a bloodline like yours, stay in your right mind, Sam. We don't want to be doing a future True Crime Tuesday show about you. All right.
I know. Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is, Dave, like for me, I strongly feel that this is what I thought was a curse is a blessing. And I think that, you know, yeah, we have a few bad apples in our family, but I also have focused. There's been a lot of good too. And I've met people that are in the field currently that I'm also related to. So this opened up a whole world to me. And hopefully I'll be able to team up with some of my family members to solve crimes. I find that we're really good at when it comes to investigating and especially true crime investigations.
Very cool. Well, keep us in the mix. Let us know when you start doing that. Hey, I don't know if you know any more about the project we worked on. Is August looking like a time it's going to be coming out? Do you know?
Yeah. So the project that we worked on, so the talk is that they're gearing for August. And
excellent.
And from what I hear, we were amazing together on camera, Dave. We're a good team. And I will say, working with you, Dave, like I don't trust a lot of people, but I trust you. And
thank you.
And there's definitely reasons why I don't trust people, because, I mean, as you know that I have a tendency of getting an attachment, you know, like that nearly killed me. And I needed to be with someone. If I go under, if I channel, I need to trust the person is going to find a way to get me out if I go under. And I trusted you on this project. And so I hope that that we can talk about it soon, because I'll tell you, it was life changing, and it was definitely something that I will never forget.
Oh, I'm on board with that. I can't wait to see the final deal, because, again, I trust you. I trust Chris Fleming and Luann, and we had an interesting time working together in a situation that was, to me, one of the most bizarre investigations and experiences. I'm still trying to come to terms with what happened to me during that. It was very uncomfortable. It's very weird, and I partially regret having not allowed it to fully manifest, if I can say, without giving stuff away. Folks, you're just gonna have to, promise, you know, Dave, you know, Tim, we're gonna be promoting shows we're a part of, so as soon as I can get official word to talk about this project, we'll be going forward with it and mentioning it. But I'm hoping August, so we're about a month away from hopefully airtime on this, and we'll get a chance to see it come to fruition. We'll do a special Thursday night live video with you, Chris Fleming, myself, maybe Luann, and get on there and talk about the case.
I would love that, because there's a lot of unfinished business that happens. I think that I'm still getting over it myself, and it happened. We filmed months ago.
Yeah, very cool stuff. Well, the book is called Mass Murders, Bloodstained Crime Scenes Haunting the Bay State. The book is out and available. We have a link for it in today's program guide, so you can find it. Sam, it's always a pleasure catching up with you, man. Thank you so much for coming on and being with us today.
Thank you so much, Dave.
It's been great chatting with you. All right, folks, let's kick open the case files. We've got them. You want them. It's time now for Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals.
It's Crayon News story time.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
All right, Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals, Tim. Since we just came off a show that dealt with a supernatural aspect of true crimes, let's talk. I mentioned two of these on last Thursday's live show, Friday's regular Darkness Radio show, but I just thought we should revisit these for true crime, dumb crime, stupid criminals. A young man allegedly killed his father and then claimed he was just baptizing the man to exorcise demons from him, including one named Dirty Dan. Is just what demon is he, like the little obnoxious demon that's got short man syndrome, and he's like, yeah you call me Dirty Dan because I'm dirty, yeah real dirty. How does a demon named Dirty Dan?
I think Dirty Dan was one from the 70s, if I remember right. Probably was from a cop show.
Probably.
Drove a really bitchin' car. Yeah. That you probably had as a collectible in your Hot Wheels collection. I got to think
like a
that's
Barracuda or something.
Yeah. That's probably the one.
Well, young man allegedly killed his father, then claimed he was baptizing the man to exorcise demons, including one named Dirty Dan. Jack Callahan, 19, appeared in court Monday in the death of Scott Callahan, 57, in Plymouth County, Massachusetts. Huh? Massachusetts, Tim.
I see.
We just talked about mass murders. I thought this was a good story to roll into, according to local reports. Police described the matter as a fatal water incident, Tim. Yeah, an early social media post saying they received a call early Monday morning of a missing man. First responders found the victim submerged in a pond. And he was later pronounced dead despite attempts to save his life. The medical examiner has yet to officially determine the cause and manner of death, but Jack Callahan has pleaded not guilty to murder. Preliminary findings is that Scott suffered from waterlogged lungs, broken blood vessels in the eyes, and an abrasion on the head, according to a statement from the Office of the Plymouth District Attorney. The story is that Jack Callahan went to a bar in Boston to get his father, who should not have been drinking, according to CBS affiliate WBZ. The men took an Uber to Island Creek Pond in the town of Duxbury, where they lived. The father is alleged to have struck the son, and then the altercation progressed to the pond. What is this, like a fight scene from Family Guy between Peter Griffin and the chicken? They start punching one place and it just keeps rolling downhill to a pond. God, further allegations complicate things beyond a mere attempt to claim self-defense. Defendant Callahan allegedly said he thought he was baptizing his father to exorcise demons. One of them was named Dirty Dan. Prosecutor Shannon Buckingham told the court, according to a report by independent television station WHDH, the Huduh, Tim.
The Huduh?
Yeah, WHDH, Huduh. He described that he was holding his father in the pond on his back like a baby and that he continually dunked the father's head in the water about 4 to 8 times. That's when the father started to cough and choke. He would lift his head up, and then when his father started to fight and strike him, he pushed the head back down into the water. So how drunk was the father, or weak was the father, that he's only 50-something, his kid is 19, and he's cradling him like a kid and pushing him underwater that you couldn't fight back? That's nuts to me. He had to have been just inebriated beyond the ability to do much on his own. I don't know.
Well, drunk, disoriented, and some people, if you have back problems, you don't have a real strong core. So if you're put on your back,
and
you're in the water, it's hard for you to really kind of sit up and fight. I mean, I could see that. It'd be real easy to drown that way. And then pretty soon, Dirty Dan the Demon Man is dunked for good.
Well, that's what he says here. He continued to dunk him into the water until his father was no longer struggling and began floating. And then I left him there to decide. You can come to heaven with me or hell. I think he chose hell, defendant Callahan said, according to the prosecutor. Defense lawyer Kevin Reddington reportedly requested a mental health evaluation and said his client might be a danger to himself. You think?
Yeah.
Good God. Well, let's head to Florida where the skies are sunny for those of you that don't speak Bass Ackwards. Here's another devil made me do it story, Tim. A Florida teen was arrested Friday on felony armed burglary charges. During his interrogation at the Indian River County Sheriff's Office, he allegedly told law enforcement he was tempted to commit the robberies by Satan and that he had planned to use any money he acquired towards college. So at least it was a good reason, Tim.
Well, yeah.
Right? It wasn't to blow it on cocaine and hookers. He wanted a college education. Rafael Woloski, an 18-year-old resident of Vero Beach, was picked up Friday evening just a few blocks from his family's home after allegedly using a broken window to enter the home of a neighbor who lived across the street. According to police documents, he was reportedly carrying a knife with a 2.5-inch blade. The defendant said he decided to burglarize homes to get money for college. He also said the devil kept tempting him to steal. That asshole. The devil is just an asshole. The report also reveals that the neighbor called 911 about a burglary in progress, saying someone broke in a house window and he was still in her home. She apparently described him to emergency services as a white male wearing a red hat and a blue shirt. He was found nearby soon after wearing a camouflage cap and red writing on the sides and a blue shirt. When officers stopped him and read him his Miranda rights, Woloski allegedly admitted to the crimes as well as two other robberies in the neighborhood. He was then taken to the sheriff's office. The report made no mention of Woloski requesting a lawyer after he confirmed he had been read his Miranda rights. Instead, he appeared to willingly give police a step-by-step breakdown of the burglary because the devil made him do it, Tim.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. Crazy.
That a-hole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's still in jail. He needs $75,000 to get out, Tim. So if you're feeling like a rich uncle and you want to help out, that's the kid to get it.
That's a little too rich for my blood, Dave.
Yeah. Wow. Even on radio money, Tim?
Yeah. Even on radio money, Dave. Yeah.
Well, let's stay topical. 4th of July was just here as we celebrate the independence of our country in the best way possible. Blowing off fingers and getting drunk, Tim.
Yeah. I can count all the way up to July 8th now.
Oh,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Firecracker. Cape Coral man wakes neighbors by screaming and pretending to be a firework. A man protesting pyrotechnics was caught on a Cape Coral security cam screaming at around 3 a.m. Firecracker, firecracker, boom, yelled the unidentified man. People living on the Southeast 10th Avenue Canal got an early 4th of July show. It wasn't one you could see, but you could definitely hear it. The dogs were barking, and we go outside, and this guy was screaming, I mean, loud, firecracker, firecracker, boom. He seemed to be upset that people were celebrating early. All of that happened just before 3 a.m. So she shouted back. He screams, firecracker, shut up, bottle rocket. Yeah, it's effing annoying, isn't it? Quit effing doing it in the middle of the night. That's what he continued yelling. Fireworks are legal in Florida on only 3 days, and the 4th of July is one of them. Pretending to be a firework is also against the law, Tim, according to noise ordinance, said Master Corporal Phil Mullen of the Cape Coral Police Department. CCPD, yeah, you know me, responded to 6 different firework-related calls from June 27th to the 28th. Warnicky has a theory on the guy was putting on his own display. He thought last year probably that I'm going to wake them up like they woke me up with their fireworks. No one in the area wanted to claim credit for the screaming. Sleep, sleep, yelled the mystery man. Work in the AM. Cuckoo, cuckoo. I like that. He's like, not even like, he's out there just yelling, bang, bang, firework, bottle rocket, zip, 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 pow.
Now, wow. I got to show you, it's not quite a related note, but it's kind of a related note. Okay. I have now, he's an absolutely wonderful neighbor, lives kitty corner from me the last couple of years, especially with COVID last year. He had his own fireworks show. And when I say fireworks show, I don't mean like little bottle rockets. I sent you 3 pictures just over to your messenger real quick if you want to take a look at them to give you an idea of the scope and size.
Yeah.
This guy has, I kid you not, a 7-cannon mortar launcher in his backyard. Wow. And you can see in that first picture, there's a shot of the guy behind him firing off a bottle rocket next to the mortar that he fired off out of his backyard.
Yeah.
And you can see the difference in scope. This guy puts on a show out of his backyard every year.
That's amazing. How does he not get arrested?
I can't say what he does for a living, but let's just say it deals with municipalities and contracts. And the mayor lives, I kid you not, the mayor lives a couple blocks away from us, and you will not see a cop car all night.
Well, you know, we down the block from us, our neighbors blow off a bunch of fireworks. They don't get this big elaborate, but there's certainly a lot of loud banging. They went till about 10:30, and we don't see cops. We had one car come driving down the road, and an old guy shook his fist. Literally, it was like a scene straight out of a movie. Rolled down his window and shook his fist. I'm calling the cops on you! And then drove away, and the cops never came. They've never come in the years I've lived this area.
No.
But boy, those are huge.
Aren't they? This guy shot off the most impressive thing I've ever seen in my life out of just a private fireworks show. He shot
That's
off
crazy.
It was a 7-cannon like sparkle salute, and it was on a timer, so it went like from right to left and right again, and it was like a sparkle shower. And I went, whoa,
that's amazing.
I sat in my driveway for an hour and a half on Sunday night, and I just watched. I didn't have to go to any municipal fireworks.
I had
it right there in my driveway. It was amazing. I just sat and clapped and hooted and hollered for the guy. I had a great 4th.
Great. Well, that does tie in with our next story. Franklin man arrested for firing off a firework mortar at Nashville police helicopters.
Oh,
wah, wah. Metro police arrested a man after he fired a firework mortar at a police helicopter shortly after midnight on Saturday. Police said that the 18-year-old John Schmid of Franklin fired the firework at the law enforcement helicopter when it was flying at around 500 feet over South Nashville near Haywood Lane. The helicopter was patrolling as part of a counter street racing initiative. Is Nashville big for street racing? That's crazy. Schmidt is facing 2 counts of aggravated assault on police and a charge of felony reckless endangerment. Yeah, folks, don't be firing off fireworks at any kind of aircraft.
No.
That's never going to work out well for you. Hey, Tim, an Indiana man was sentenced to 60 days imprisonment and banned from Yellowstone National Park for 5 years. Was he feeding Yogi Bear? What do you think he was doing there, Tim? Disorderly conduct. Kyle F. Campbell, 31, of Fairmont, was also given a five-year term of unsupervised probation, ordered to pay $1,550 in fines and a $50 special assessment fee stemming from his behavior on June 21st at Grant Marina on Yellowstone Lake. Yellowstone National Park announced on Wednesday. Campbell was with a group of individuals who had been scheduled for a guided kayak trip at Grant Marina in Yellowstone National Park. The National Park stated in a news release, this guide refused to take the group as he thought they were too intoxicated. Campbell said his group became upset and created a disturbance that led the kayak guide to call security officers and park law enforcement rangers. Hey, boo-boo, Mr. Smith is coming. This is a good time for us to raid the picnic baskets. During the encounter, Campbell made threatening comments and gestured towards the officers. He also exhibited signs of being intoxicated and refused to obey officers' orders. Campbell continually struggled and kicked at the rangers, resisting arrest and later injuring himself while banging his head in the patrol car. People are so stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah, this story goes on for like 3 pages. I'm not even going to read it. Everything's covered in there. They end up saying, this is for the official release from Yellowstone National Park. Stay sober, because unruly and intoxicated behavior will only earn you a spot with the jailbirds rather than enjoying the beauty and adventure that is Yellowstone Park. Hey, let's get out of here quick, boo-boo. A man posing as a police officer pulled over an off-duty deputy who recognized him as an imposter from an earlier domestic incident.
Whoops.
Yeah, Louisiana man, Tim.
Louisiana.
Yeah, Louisiana.
Yep.
You know, like good old King Lou. Louisiana man was arrested this week.
It's Louis, Dave. Louisiana. Louis.
Yeah, Louisiana man.
No.
Was arrested this week after law enforcement authorities say he impersonated a police officer and tried to execute an unlawful traffic stop on another vehicle. Unfortunately for the alleged counterfeit cop, the driver of the vehicle he is said to have pulled over was not only an off-duty sheriff's deputy, but he was a sheriff's deputy who had responded to a domestic violence call earlier in the year involving the same idiot patrolman, fake patrolman, I should say. Bottom line, the deputy knew the defendant wasn't a member of law enforcement, the local sheriff has said. Wah, wah. Wonder, do they say how much he's put away for it? Nope, they don't. But they did impound his car. Oh, yes. He was released after posting a commercial bond in the amount of $10,000. That's all it costs to try to pull people over, Tim.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to go start doing that right now. I'm going to make a weekend of it.
I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that. But talking about counterfeit cops, Tim, let's roll right into this story. In Waterboro, Maine, a man in Maine tried to post a $200 bail using counterfeit bills. Deputies responding to a report of a stolen vehicle in Waterboro early Sunday morning stopped a man walking nearby. The York County Sheriff's Office wrote in Facebook posts. They determined that he was not involved, but arrested him on an outstanding warrant for theft from a Walmart. The man said he had enough money to post $200 in bail, but when the bail commissioner arrived, he tried to pay with two counterfeit $100 bills. It's because it didn't have Ben Franklin on it. It had Franklin from the Peanuts gang, Tim. That's a problem. He was denied bail and was returned to jail with the additional charge of forgery. The man was able to post $100 in bail later in the day, the sheriff's office said. His court date is scheduled for August 4th. So wait a minute. I'm confused. So he was stopped for a warrant from theft from Walmart. His bail was $200, in which he tried to pay them with false $100 bills. He was then put away for that crime, and he was able to post $100 in bail later. Shouldn't it have been a total of $300 at least at that point?
You would think, yeah.
You would think it'd be a lot more for trying to pass bad currency, unless there's more to the story that they haven't told us. Like, he got the bills from, you know, Mike the Paperboy or something. I don't know. Why would Mike the Paperboy have $100 bills that are counterfeit? I couldn't tell you.
Or from an actual ATM that didn't have counterfeit bills.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. All right, Tim. Our next case is one of swift justice. Swift justice. Swift justice.
Oh, hurt my neck.
This is this. I understand this.
Mm-hmm.
And this would probably happen in my home as well. A peeping Tom was shot 3 times by a Texas father after allegedly touching himself while peering into a 10-year-old's window.
Whoa.
Yep. Fox 26 Houston reported that Jorge Ramos, age 44, has been charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon and indecency with a child by exposure. The report said that the suspect is still hospitalized after the June 28th incident in Northwest Harris County. The report, citing court documents, said the girl alerted her parents about a man after he allegedly tapped on her window while touching himself. Her parents, who were not identified, retrieved their guns and confronted the suspect. I love it. The family that shoots together stays together. They both just grab their guns. We're going to handle this Old West style. Deputy said the girl's mother held the man at gunpoint outside the gas station as the father headed inside to tell the clerk to call 911, but that's when the suspect began wrestling the woman for her gun. He managed to disarm the woman and pointed her own gun in her direction, but the husband soon raced outside the gas station, firing at the suspect out of fear he'd shoot his wife. Yeah. Here's the tip. If I find you peeking in my kid's window and playing whack-a-mole, you're going to die.
I was going to say, I'm surprised he made the hospital.
Yeah. It wouldn't have been me holding him at gunpoint. I would have shot out his wiener. That would have been the end of his wiener. I might have let him live, but the wiener would have been paying for it. That's just sick.
You would bleed out pretty quickly. I mean, that's the thing. I'm surprised you make the hospital.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, Tim, last week we had the great fast food wars. Burger King, guns, McDonald's blowing up, right?
Yep.
Threats to blow it up. Well, a Missouri man was found guilty of assaulting a McDonald's manager with a rake after his daughter was fired by the fast food restaurant earlier in the day. See, that's St. Louis for you, not Texas, Tim. Texas, they run in and get their guns. Missouri, they grab a rake.
Evidently, there's some leaves that need to be cleaned up.
Yeah. St. Louis County Circuit Judge Nellie Ribadeau ruled that Kendall R. Cooks, 38, was guilty of felony counts of first-degree assault and armed criminal action alongside a misdemeanor count of property damage for the incident that took place in Chesterfield, Missouri. The attack occurred about 90 minutes after Cook's daughter was fired by the manager of the McDonald's, Jeffrey Jackson, for allegedly not wearing the correct work attire and using inappropriate language in front of customers, according to local station KPLR, the Puller, Tim. Following his daughter's firing, the 38-year-old and several others drove to the McDonald's, and Cooks picked up a 5-foot-long wooden and metal rake from a nearby dumpster. Cooks blocked in Jackson's car, which the manager was occupying during his break, and then smashed the driver's side window of the vehicle with the rake before striking him several times, according to Ribadeau's ruling. Part of the attack was filmed on Jackson's dashboard camera, and evidence from photos showed glass and blood inside the victim's vehicle following the incident. Jackson told the court that he was hospitalized for a week following the attack and had to undergo 5 surgeries to repair his vision. He lost one of his eyes as a consequence of the incident, which he proved by taking out his prosthetic eye for the judge.
What?
Ribadeau faces up to 30 years in prison when he is sentenced. Yep. Listen, I might get mad if they fired my kid, and I might make a call and try to find out what happened. There's got to be alcohol or drugs. At what point do you feel vindicated that you just show up at your kid's place of employment and start swinging with a rake or any weapon? Unless they've touched or like sexually harassed your daughter. Not that I'm saying you should take the law into your own hands. You should take him to court, Tim. The people's court.
That's right.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yep.
Dun, dun, dun. So you thought those were some violent ways to go. How about this one, Tim? A factory worker in Italy.
In Italy, you say?
Has avoided jail time after she hit her colleague on the head with a chocolate bar, resulting in the woman being hospitalized with a head injury and a broken tooth. A chocolate bar, you say? Yeah. The incident took place at the Lascia chocolate factory in Arona, Italy, on my birthday, November 22nd, when the two workers at the facility began arguing for a sustained period during a public demonstration about chocolate. After the argument became heated, the woman picked up, Tim, a chocolate bar and hit her colleague over the head with it, causing the worker to end up in the emergency room with a broken tooth and a head injury. Oh, did I mention, Tim, that the chocolate bar weighed 2.2 pounds?
Oh, okay.
No. Yeah, that's a hell of a Hershey.
Yeah.
All right, kiss this. Bam! The victim suffered from the head injury for 15 days. The woman was reported to the local police for assault. She was fined by Lazio for the incident, according to an article on in the Italian newspaper La Repubblica. But a judge on Thursday, June 24th, ruled out the woman did not need to stand trial for the incident because she had completed a period of socially useful work that her lawyers had set up for her. The judge decided not to proceed with the trial against the worker after she successfully completed socially useful work, meaning the case was dismissed and the charges were dropped. How about that? You just get pissed off and wallop somebody with a 2-pound chocolate bar.
Jeez.
Is it so that the package splits and you're like, well, I might as well eat it now. I can't sell it.
The last time somebody tried to swing some chocolate my way, I devoured it before it could even get to my mouth. Yeah.
Yeah. You think Shark Week's exciting? Just dangle a McRib, a Twinkie, or a chocolate bar in front of Tim or I and watch the real action.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, Tim, I'm gonna send you a photograph.
Okay.
And I'm going to let you see. You showed me the beauty and majesty of fireworks. I'm going to show you the beauty and majesty of a female jail guard who has been sentenced for having sex with inmates in lieu of other prisoners.
My, take me to jail.
Right?
Yeah.
Tina Gonzalez, 26, took responsibility for her crimes at the Fresno County Jail, but also had been made vulnerable by the recent end of her marriage. She is smoking. It's not like some angry looking, prison guard. She's gorgeous.
Oh, daddy like.
Yeah, a California corrections officer who had sex with an inmate in full view of 11 others is going to serve 210 days locked up, followed by 2 years of probation. The sentence delivered Tuesday by Judge Michael Eidart in Fresno County followed testimony by Assistant Sheriff Steve McComas, who said the actions of former county jail guard Tina Gonzalez were something only a depraved mind could come up with. Really? Really?
I could come up with it pretty easy.
Yeah. According to Fresno TV station KSEE, Tim, the C, the sheriff's office began to investigate after staff members were tipped in December to a county jail inmate with a cell phone who also was said to be in a sexual relationship with an officer. The search of the inmate's cell turned up the phone, and Gonzalez quit the sheriff's office after being interviewed by detectives, the outlet reports. Gonzalez, 26, pleaded no contest to a felony count of sexual activity by a detention facility employee with a consenting confined adult, a felony count of possession of a facility, and a misdemeanor count of possession of cellular device. So there you have it, Tim. Oh, good God. Are you ready for this part?
Okay.
McComas elaborated on the allegations in court, saying an investigation showed not only that Gonzalez had sex with the inmate, but she also gave the inmate razors, a potential weapon behind bars, and told him when officers would inspect his cell. Gonzalez cut a hole in her uniform to make sex with the inmate easier, and her actions were witnessed by 11 other inmates.
Oh, my.
Phone logs revealed Gonzalez kept in contact with the inmate even after she was caught. She took an oath, which she betrayed, and in doing so endangered coworkers' lives. What the? And I'm not saying, well, she's pretty, she should, not face jail time. It's just like she couldn't find love anywhere else. I mean, I understand a lot of us meet the people we date in our work environments, but this just seems like a bad place to meet somebody.
Yeah, probably not the best place.
What you did, girl, was terrible, stupid, and you've ruined your career, Judge Eidart told Gonzalez in court, according to the B. But I also believe that people can redeem themselves, and you have the rest of your life to do that. Gonzalez faced a maximum sentence of 3 years and 8 months in prison. The prosecution recommended a sentence of 16 months in prison, with Till Snick requesting probation. Gonzalez has worked as a correctional officer since 2016. I don't know if you want to send her to jail. That's where she apparently likes to be and gets hot and bothered there.
Yeah, I don't think you'd come very far with, and I'm trying to choose my words carefully here. I don't think you would come very far with rehabilitation with her. Yeah,
yeah, maybe not. I don't know. Yeah. Our final story comes from Florida, Tim. A 25-year-old Florida man was charged with attempted murder after shooting at police officers from his balcony. He claims he thought he was in a video game. Kyle Raymond was arrested Sunday after firing at two police officer cars that responded to his Boca Raton apartment building after 911 calls about an unstable man screaming in the parking lot. Raymond fired 13 rounds from a 40 caliber 6-hour P229 handgun from the balcony to the street below, hitting one cop's tire and piercing the other's roof, according to an affidavit obtained by the South Florida Sun-Sentinel on Monday. Kyle Raymond is his name, I guess. Several other guns were found inside his apartment when officers served a search warrant. He believes someone poisoned him, an officer wrote in an affidavit. He believed that he was being controlled in a video game. He believed that his actions were being controlled by someone else, and he was the active participant. Tim, he was the skin in this Fortnite game of reality call life.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Another officer specified that Raymond thought he was inside a game similar to Grand Theft Auto. Raymond was charged with two counts of first-degree attempted murder of law enforcement officers and unlawful discharging of a firearm, according to online jail records. Wah, wah. What a cuckoo bird.
Yep.
Crazy-ass stuff. Well, that's it for this week, kids. I hope that you enjoyed the program as much as we enjoyed bringing it to you. We'll be back this week, Wednesday and Thursday, with brand new episodes of Darkness Radio, the best in paranormal podcasting. There will be no live show this week, as I will be in Duluth. Duluth! Duluth is on fire! We don't need no water! Let the mother burn!
Wow.
No, I'm going to be in Duluth at a paranormal conference. So, again, if you guys are out and about, check out mnparacon.com. That's mnparacon.com. Come on out and see me this weekend in Duluth. Chris Fleming's going to be there. Dustin Perry's going to be there. Steve Gonzalez is going to be there. A lot of great people from the paranormal community are going to be at this conference. It's going to be a big one and a lot of fun, and I hope you guys will come out. By the way, I'm giving out free hugs, Tim. And I promise you this, I don't think I'm in a video game.
Mm-hmm.
Or will I beat you with food? Because I'd rather eat food than beat someone with it. And I promise I will not peeping Tom you. Unless, of course, you pay for that, but that is a separate charge, and an affidavit will need to be signed. That's all I'm saying. Yes.
Yeah.
So no live show Thursday night. We'll be back to doing that in a couple of weeks. I think I'm gone next week as well, because I'm going to be at the Belvoir Winery doing an event with Amy Bruni, Adam Berry, and Cindy Kaza, just to name a few. John E.L. Tenney, I believe, will be on hand. Aaron Sagers. And information for all the events I'll be at are at darknessevents.com. That's darknessevents.com. So go check that out as well. All right, that's it for today. We'll be back tomorrow with the best in paranormal podcasting. I'm Dave. That's Tim. You've been listening to True Crime Tuesday.